Good evening, everybody. This is Josh Spicer from GameWisdom.com, where we examine the art and science of games. And welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast. We have a great cast for you this week. We're going to be catching up with a developer that I spoke to probably by the time you're listening to this cast right now. It'll be, I want to say, 3 or 4 months, maybe even more than that. But
he, more than that.
Oh, thank you. And I guess there's our reveal there. Please welcome to back to the cast, fan of the site and owner of Jara Technology. He released the game Concealed Intent about 5-6 months ago. Charles.
Hello. Yes, it was. It was right. I know it very clearly because it was a couple of weeks before the game Concealed Intent was released. So it was mid-July.
Yep, and it's great to have you back on. I know we were just speaking before the cast. It feels like it's been longer than that. That's the crazy thing about like this industry and doing these casts. Like 2 months feels like a year. I recently spoke with Zach Barth again from Zachtronics. It's only been, I think the last time we spoke was like a year ago. And it feels like I've spoken to him in like a decade.
I can assure you, it feels exactly the same here. As a game developer, having your game released, well, 4 or 5 months ago, it feels like forever. Like, why haven't I done another game yet? It's been ages.
Yes. And for those of you listening, Charles, you are located, did you say you're in Singapore? Or
Malaysia.
Malaysia. I knew it was one of those two. So we also have the time difference. Is it like, it's like 9 o'clock in the morning your time, right?
It is. It's a slightly overcast morning here in Kuala Lumpur.
Nice.
It's the rainy season, so it's going to rain soon.
And it looks like we're finally entering the cold season here on the East Coast. I can finally start to think about putting away my shorts, you know, in November where it's still like 60, 70 degrees here. Oh, boy.
I actually don't know what that means. What's 60? Do you know what that is in Celsius?
No, I have enough trouble, unfortunately, with the time zone differences.
I'll assume it's cold.
Yeah. But weather is definitely finally catching up with the winter season. It'll probably just about cold, and then we'll go back into spring again. The whole schedule gets screwed up once again. But enough about weather patterns, I think, for the cast. So to get started with Charles, like we said, it's been 6 months, possibly 2-3 years in terms of our heads since we last spoke. How is everything going since we last talked?
Well, the Concealed Intent release, my main concern is that there were no bad bugs. I didn't want there to be a crashing bug when I released it, and there wasn't, so I'm very happy with that. In terms of sales, which I think is probably what we'll be talking about quite a bit later, it was about what I expected, but not what I had hoped.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I was a little optimistic, but I think you have to be when you're writing an indie game.
Yeah. And for those of you who missed the previous cast, there should be a link to that in the notes below. But for those of you who didn't play the game, Concealed Intent was Charles's take on the simultaneous turn-based strategy genre, or the, I think it's called, what is it considered, WIGO? Is that the other term for it?
I've heard people say that on some of the groups I'm on, yes.
Mm-hmm. So it is part of the WIGO genre, where two players will enter in their turn simultaneously, and then the game will basically compile them and then play out the results. If you've seen the game Frozen Synapse that came out a few years ago, that is a pretty close model, very similar to Concealed Intent in terms of that kind of WIGO design.
Definitely. That was a very strong influence and a very conscious influence when I designed the game.
Mm-hmm. And the other unique factor, of course, is the idea of using sonar to detect ships in space. There is that kind of like submarine-style battle, but on a three-dimensional plane with ships, you know, flying X, Y, and Z.
Yep, it's a spaceship game, a science fiction game. And there is an attempt to get a bit of a stealth element in there.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. One last bit of catch-up, we also did a Building the Game segment where Charles and I hung out on Twitch and played it, and Charles did proceed to beat me, I think it was like 2 out of 3 times. I don't know if I snuck by with a win or we tied, I forget.
We tied, because a couple of months ago in October, I was beaten for the first time, and then about 30 minutes later, I was beaten for the second time.
Nice. Oh, right. So as we just said, regarding Concealed Tent, it has been a few months since it came out. I know a few months ago, you did write a post on Gama Sutra, sort of detailing the post-mortem of the game. And again, for those of you listening to this cast who want to read it, that should also be located in the podcast notes.
Mm-hmm. That was just before the 1.1 update. Mm-hmm. So in mid-October, I put it on sale and released the 1.1 update with Linux support and some extra content. Mm-hmm. And as part of that, I put out that post. So now I have a bit more information as well.
All right. Now, obviously, as you were just saying a few minutes ago, sales were expected, but of course not as high as I think everyone was hoping for.
Yes, I've been told to expect a few times more sales in the release month than I had in my entire time in Early Access. Concealed Intent was on Early Access for 9 months. Mm-hmm. And so I was expecting that the sales would be several times the entire Early Access mm-hmm. over the release month. Mm-hmm. And that is pretty much exactly what it was. If you look at the sales numbers on the Gama Sutra post, mm-hmm. you can see it was about a bit more than twice as many sold in a month, a bit under three times as many sold in a month as I sold in the entire 9 months of Early Access. And I'd heard from other people that that's roughly what you should expect, two to four times as many.
Mm. And as you just said, Charles, you were in Early Access for how long did it remain in Early Access for? Did you just say a year?
9 months.
9 months, okay. And that's always one of the trickiest things, especially with games in Early Access, is what happens when they're officially released. We've seen some cases where a lot of developers will sort of just quietly roll it out. They may have one new edition. Some developers have gone, you know, this is like the big moment, something huge gets added. I know Darkest Dungeon wait until release to add in their final level. And it's always tricky managing, like, what's going to take your game from Early Access to, you know, officially 1.0.
For me, it was, I already knew what I wanted to do when I put it in Early Access. I had, like, a couple of paths of things I could do. And I asked the community, the people who bought it in the first few months of Early Access, mm-hmm. what they thought was most important. And so then I just worked on that. Got to the what I considered an acceptable standard along that path. Mm-hmm. Tested it a huge amount, and then released it. So there was no big thing added at the last moment, mm-hmm. Or even in the last I think 6 weeks. I was only bug fixes, and that was entirely intentional. I salute the bravery of anyone who is willing to put a big change into their title right before a release.
Yeah, that
I'm not that brave.
Oh yeah, that is definitely crazy when you have to add something that big in, and then of course the game comes out like a week later, and then of course the patching and bug fixes that entail.
Yeah, there was no way I was going to do that. I was absolutely petrified of a breaking bug because I don't have much marketing muscle. I just had to send out free keys and see what happened. Mm-hmm. And we can talk about that as well later.
Yeah.
So if it came out and people played it and there was a bug, then that would be just the way, in my mind at least, it would be sales death.
Yeah.
So there was no way I was doing that. And most of the work was finished like a couple of months before, and then it was just a matter of waiting till appropriate time. The only thing I'd say is I released it a week earlier than I attended because the day I originally chose was the day No Man's Sky came out.
Oh.
So I moved it forward a week.
Oh, man, No Man's Sky, that's definitely a discussion in and of itself because I think a lot of people are just still kind of examining, I guess, like the fallout of that game's release.
Yes, I mean, I think it's an important lesson for indie developers there on how to do release, or perhaps how not to do release, or how to not to do your marketing.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't deny the success of their sales. It's a huge number of sales. Mm-hmm. So I can't fault them too much.
Now, one thing that we talked about last time when you were on was sort of the distinction between what the fans want regarding, you know, extensive multiplayer options or the kind of like infinite skirmish mode, being able to set up a procedurally generated map, stuff like that. Now, multiplayer is one of those topics, I think we talked about this last time, that can be very polarizing. I think we mentioned the ever-popular example of people think multiplayer can happen 1 week. That's all it takes to design a multiplayer system, and it's fully developed.
Yes.
With the release of Concealed Intent, how did, I guess, things fare? Like, was there a lot of pushback or people asking for more involved multiplayer?
There was a little bit, but not much. About as much as there was during early access, which was much less than people who wanted skirmish. Mm-hmm. I think the main thing people have is a couple of people actually, because you get a report when people refund. You can type in a little message, and a couple of people wrote in that they were unhappy with the multiplayer, and that's why they were refunding. And I think that's completely fair because. I think, as we said previously, the problem with multiplayer in indie game is that there's no scale, and you cannot get a random game. You have to know the person you're going to be playing and challenge them directly if you want to play online Concealed Intent. That's just the way it is. So as a multiplayer game, I don't think it's been particularly successful. It certainly works. You can play it, but you have to know who you're playing before you start. You're not going to get a random. And so a few people have complained about that, but about the same number that were complaining before, to be honest. And there were a few other things that people were talking about, multiplayer, like more options or turn notifications, which I've tried to put in. But in general, it's been quite low. There was quite the other two things that people have talked a lot about is Linux support, which I actually put in, which was surprisingly easier than I thought. But doesn't make much difference to your sales. And modding support, which a lot of people have asked for, or localization support. I put those two together because I'm not going to do either of them. It's not going to happen.
Yeah. And that's one of the challenges, again, as an independent developer, is obviously the fact that your resources are going to be far limited compared to a major studio. And I think that's kind of why... you said a few minutes ago that you wanted to make sure Concealed Intent was bug-free upon release. You wanted to get the indie be in as perfect of a state that you could make it.
Absolutely. Yeah. That was... If I play a game and it crashes or there's a bug, that's... I get angry. I get angry and mad at the developer, and I didn't want to be that person.
Yeah.
And I certainly know that, you know, if you played a lot, you can cover most of the issues. I mean, a couple slipped through, but they were... nothing that really caused people to stop playing.
Yeah.
And they're fixed now.
That's good. When we last spoke, you were talking about possibly doing some kind of expansion or post-release content. Is that still in the cards or has that been scrapped?
No, I did a 1.1 release in October. So that in that situation, I brought out Linux support. I brought out Steam turn notifications because a couple of regular players asked for that. And I brought out some people came up with some really good ideas to how to make the GUI and the way it worked nicer. So there was about three or four of those I could get done quickly, so I just did them. And a couple of a new type of skirmish, I put that in as well. So there's that. I mean, what I said was I'd do a month's work followed by testing. So just a month's development work. And then this is the order of things I will do. And I got through like all but two items on the list. So what I'm thinking of doing is not right now, but next year I'll do another month for a 1.2 release. And I should be able to get those done and a few more suggestions and ideas that have come up.
All right, that's good. And for those of you listening, we did talk briefly that you're playing another game, but of course, it's still way too early to start talking about specifics on that one.
Yes, I mean, it's still going to be space-based, because it's not going to be multiplayer, online multiplayer, that's sure. And it's going to be heavily influenced by board games. But beyond that, I haven't even worked out a proper name for it yet. So I think that if you're going to market something, at least it should have something to hang people's remembrance on, like the name.
Yeah.
And so I really need to work that out first. Naming- and besides, at the moment...
Yep,
it's still developer graphics, so it is so ugly.
Naming is probably one of my big Achilles' heels. I am horrible with coming up with witty names for things. You don't even want to see like my naming process for like characters in RPGs. It's just me just literally typing letters in RAM to see if it sounds like something that could be pronounceable.
Yes, I just normally use the default, so I'm even worse.
I've done that. If the game does have like a random option, just like start randoms, I'll just like hit it like 20 times until something goes, okay, that sounds all right. And then, of course, I'll hit it too quick and I'll skip it and like, damn, like I hit it again to find that name again.
Yes.
But getting back to more with Concealed Intent. Now, this is one of those topics I know it's very tricky to talk about, especially with the release of an indie game. I know for people listening to this cast, be it developers or consumers slash enthusiasts, it is certainly a topic that I think definitely needs to come up more about what happens after the release of the game, especially in terms of what the developer does next for their studio. And I know this is it's one of those topics, again, that a lot of people don't like talking about, but I know you, as we mentioned a few minutes ago, you did write your piece on Concealed Intent on Gama Sutra, and I guess we'll be sort of leapfrogging or springboarding off of that to talk about more about what's happening now, or kind of like what you've been doing.
Okay.
Now, if do you want to start, or?
sorry. Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, I mean, with the release, I've always been, I think, quite open about what my plans are. So I'm quite happy to talk about that. I mean, I've done a 1.1 release. I said I'd do it. I've done it. I'll do a 1.2 release. But at the same time, I'm not going to be – how should I put this? I don't want to be a hobbyist. It's looking – probably the way things are looking, that's how it's going to end up. Concealed Intent, I'm not – it will make the costs back, but it won't be enough to provide me with a living. In fact, you know, it'll be cents on the hour of development time. So it's so I've got one more chance because I've got time and money for one more go, 6 months. So a much quicker go than last time. But and after that, if it doesn't work out, I'm a hobbyist. But until then, I'm still I want to be able to create a self-sustaining indie game for one-man studio, one-person studio. So that requires, since Concealed Intent will not be it, that requires me to do another game, another attempt.
And that's always one of those, like one of the harsh realities of being an independent developer. And I know it's one thing, again, that a lot of students or people outside don't really know, that it's very tricky sometimes to earn enough back to keep going or earn enough back to really support yourself strictly off of games. I think there's that general consensus from a lot of people that there's that allure, you know, that you're just sitting around making video games all day and the money's rolling in kind of thing. And it's really not like that at all.
Well, the second part's definitely not like that. there's certainly no money rolling in. Well, there's money coming in from Steam, but it's not it's not enough to live on. Go on.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I was going to say, if you go to that, if you go to the Gama Sutra article, there's a graph there that sort of breaks it down. So the direct costs, my indirect costs, and how much it cost me to live during the time I was making it, and comparing that to how much money has actually come in, and even if you update it for the last 2 months, I mean the angle of it going up has been roughly the same because of thanks to sales. But it's not the the slope is not ever enough to just reach the cost of me living for the 4 years I developed it. And when I say 4 years, that's, I think, was the main problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And that's another part about making a video game, especially, I think we touched on this last time, when you're designing an original game and building the engine at the same time, it just, you know, it adds to that workload exponentially.
Yes, it does. Let me just turn that mail program off. The largest cost by a massive way is the cost of just supporting yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an issue that many people forget. I know Klipsky, the guy who does Positech games, mm-hmm. he goes on about it quite a lot, that people say, oh, you know, the game made a profit, but not when you take into account mm-hmm. your personal time,
yeah.
which is really what you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, it's by far the largest expense. And the longer you take to write a game, the larger that expense is going to be.
Yeah. And again, like with the games that are like the most challenging, like a game like Concealed Intent, and even titles like anything from Stardew Valley, Renown Explorers, these are games that are built entirely as original games. Like not Stardew Valley, probably more Renown Explorers and something like Undertale. These are games that there really isn't, again, that magical checklist that you can go down to figure out how this game works. And we've said this multiple times on these casts, but no game design plan stays exactly the same from beginning to end. Things will always change. Mechanics may be altered. You mentioned this on the last cast, if I remember, that you did open up the design to a lot of editing and changing mechanics as per the your fans, but there were a few things, including like the sonar and that kind of system, that you did not, that you were adamant on not removing, because that was essentially the key component of the game.
That's right. That's completely correct. Yeah, yeah, and everything else changed massively. The amount of a huge part of the time in developing the game was just rework, because your original ideas don't feel the way you want them to feel. So you just end up doing them over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And especially for me, because it was my first game, I didn't really know what I was doing at the start.
Mm-hmm.
So that multiplied the issue.
Yeah, I mean, that's another part about game development. We've talked about this, I think, more on recent casts, but the importance of iteration to refining a game and making the best version of that title as possible. But there's always that contradiction that for some of our best games have come from sequels, you know, number two, number three, but many games are set up to be almost, you know, it's either going to succeed or it's going to ruin the company kind of thing. One and done. Or, you know, it has to just do well enough to get that sequel, and then it's usually the sequel that is that defining moment for that specific game or series.
I can completely believe that. If I was to do this game again, which I'm not going to do, but if I was, I could, right now, maybe I'm being optimistic, but I'm reasonably confident I could do it incredibly better than I have the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of the things I've learned along the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what we see, especially in the independent market, is that for a lot of developers, sometimes, or in many cases, that they don't get that second, or even, you know, very rarely, a third chance to make that game. But when I talk to a lot of developers, especially when you hear advice that developers have for new people in the industry, they're just going to say, just keep making video games, just keep doing it. But in many cases, a lot of people just don't have that luxury to keep putting out products that aren't earning enough to live on.
It's very much, I think that's very much the case. If I'm very lucky that I have essentially 4.5 years of time, and it was always 4.5 years,
mm-hmm.
Because of my partner's work situation. So I won't go into that. Mm-hmm. But so I had 4.5 years. And so that's given me the opportunity to make, have a second attempt. Otherwise, that would be it. It would be over. Concealed mm-hmm. Intent came out. Mm-hmm. I couldn't, if I was living in London right now, which is where I was before, there is no way I could do this again after Concealed Intent.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to go and get another job, and then I'd be a hobbyist. So I think when, but at the same time, the more games you make, the better you're going to be at the process. And that makes, so it makes a lot of sense. So, you know, my advice would be, for a start, make them small.
Yeah.
So you can get them done quick. And yeah, keep making games, because you will get better at it. I'm reasonably confident from a game design point of view that my next game will be better than Concealed Intent. I probably shouldn't say that. but I just think with Concealed Intent, because I had to do things over and over again, and this time I think I can do it quicker. Because I'll be able to avoid some of the pitfalls, and I'll go into completely new pitfalls. So hopefully, hopefully they won't take me as long.
Yeah. Now, one thing you mentioned a few minutes ago, Charles, I think definitely we can talk about here, is the use of marketing and the challenges, especially for a first-time indie developer in terms of getting your name out there and getting your game out there. Because, again, this is another one of those topics I think is rarely discussed outside of, you know, private communities and private groups of developers. So you brought up keys, and I think that's another very interesting topic, because there's always that's another part that we don't really hear too much about, at least from the consumer standpoint, of, you know, knowing who to give your keys out to, how many keys. I think in, either in that post or one of the other posts you wrote about, you talked about sort of the challenges of knowing who to deal with when it comes to, you know, trying to get your game promoted with them.
Absolutely. I still have to say I don't know exactly how to do it. I sent out a bit under 200 keys to people, because what I heard, and what I heard from other, a lot of other local indie devs, is you just you send out the keys to the contact numbers, so the contact emails of people you know, or people you have contact details for, and YouTubers and web magazines and things like that. And if you're lucky, they will cover you. I didn't know anyone personally, so I haven't been to a conference and got people's, you know, the rock paper shotgun people's contact address or anything like that. So I just had to cold send them. Majority, although some people, mostly smaller people, sent me requests as well. But that's another issue about the possibility of scams.
Yeah.
So I just had to sort of cold send them out, and I'm not sure. I think 200 is probably not very many compared to most people, and the vast majority were just ignored. In fact, they weren't even used. You can tell. I can tell how many of that 200 were used, and the key were how many were redeemed on Steam, and the majority were not even redeemed.
Yeah.
It's sort of what you expect. I mean, if you're sending someone cold, you can't, you know, assume that they'll do anything. I thought more people would try it, but if you're sending it cold, you just have to take what you get.
I guess one question for you, Charles: when you sent the keys out, did you include like a little like press release or like a little description of the game, stuff like that?
Yes, I had a paragraph about what the game was. For probably half the sites, I wrote a little line about their site or their videos, because I send it to people that I watched as well.
Yeah.
And then I also included a set of social media links and a link to my press release, because I use the do press release system, which is, I think, quite standard now. If any indie developers are listening and they're not using do press release, it makes it quite simple, and pretty much everyone seems to do it.
Yeah. Now, I guess one other question for you, because I was actually talking to another developer about this off the record, and we talked about having like pictures or GIFs in the email just to show the game off. Did you do any of that, or was it just text?
It was just text and links to pictures. I had heard that you shouldn't put pictures or videos in the email, but. So I didn't try it. What would you recommend as someone who receives these emails?
I think for me personally, I would like at least some kind of screenshot showing your game off, just so I have at least some idea what I'm looking at with the game. Because I think for one of the things I think I've certainly have learned with the YouTube channel is that the old classic adage, you know, picture is worth a thousand words kind of thing. And that just, like, I'm not saying, you know, put 5-6 different pictures in your email, but at least something to just show what the game is. Just to make it a little bit easier for someone who gets a lot of emails just to say it. But I don't know if I'm in the minority or if other people feel that way.
Well, I mean, it's you're the only data point I've got.
But yeah, I was talking to another developer about that, and I said, you know, like, I said maybe include like a picture list, but they say don't do that. So I don't know.
Yeah, that's the advice I had as well.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
And it's always tricky, again, when you're trying to reach out to these people, because you never know if they're going to get back or not. I think one other suggestion that I would have is try to make it so if you don't have Steam, I know there are a lot of indie developers who are using stuff like Ichigo and other services I'm not aware of. Try to make your download version as easy as possible. For instance, I'm not going to name names. Someone sent me access to their game that was on this website. I went to download it, and instead of getting a file or executable, I got something that would require me to unzip it in a different way, like using like another program. I just thought, I don't have the time for that right now to, you know, go those extra steps. And I think just like with anything else, the easier you make your game or your content to be viewed or used, the better it's going to be overall for people.
Yes, definitely. I think something to remember is just when you send someone an email, mm-hmm. chances are that the person you're sending it to will be receiving hundreds of these mm-hmm. emails. So you have to make it as easy as possible for them. Like, as no impediment to them getting your game. Like, don't mm-hmm. ask anything for them. Don't say contact me for a key or for a copy if you're interested. Just mm-hmm. just make it as easy as possible, because they'll probably only have like, you've probably only got like 5 to 30 seconds to catch their attention enough for them to download it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
When I released on Steam, this was something that surprised me. Just as someone who released a game on Steam, I received probably a couple of hundred emails within a couple of days mm-hmm. of people asking and requesting things and trying to sell me things. And mm-hmm. if you don't get to the point within the first couple of sentences, well, you know, I've got another 199 emails to get through, and there's only one of me. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you have to get to the point quickly.
Yeah, and then there's of course a challenge of if someone contacts you. I know this was a part of the post you wrote about how to, like, prove your credentials. So, again, on the flip side, I think, just as when you're emailing a YouTuber or a press person, you know, they could be receiving dozens, if not hundreds, of emails a day, there's also the reverse of that. If you're trying to get in touch with a developer for a press copy, how to, you know, put your best foot forward on that end.
Yeah, I think that was a different post, but mm-hmm. yes, and there's lots of posts out there. Because if you release a game on Steam, you will get a lot of people asking for free keys, mm-hmm. and a lot of them are just clearly scams.
Yeah,
it's just you know, people with email addresses that are different but slightly similar, you know, to well known YouTubers. People asking for, you know, a huge number of keys.
Yeah.
I mean, I had one people from an up and coming website, up and coming meaning doesn't currently exist. And they wanted 20 keys for testing.
What?
And we're like, I'm not really sure about that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, lots of people saying, "Can you give me 100 keys so I can give them away in my Steam group because it'll be good marketing," which I'm not really sure about. A lot of that. It's interesting that those requests have changed slightly. I used to get about one of those a week, but since Steam changed their review policy, I don't seem to get them so much anymore.
Yeah,
because it used to be the line, you know, send us 100 copies and we'll write good reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And now they don't do that.
And now that, for those of you who missed the news about that, Steam reviews for games or for copies of games that aren't bought directly through Steam aren't factored into the rating for the game on Steam or the main rating. It still shows up, But in terms of factoring, like when you see overwhelmingly positive or negative or whatever, those reviews don't count.
Yeah, yeah, that was a big change. I lost a few good reviews from that, from the people I sent out early copies to.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that is, I know we debated about this on the podcast a few months ago. It is very much a very tricky subject, because again, there are developers like yourself and a few that I've also spoken to who relied on those, on press copies or Kickstarter back copies to get the word of mouth going. And then the other side is, and where the criticism comes in, of course, are the developers like you, or the people like you just mentioned, Charles, the ones who say, I'm just going, you know, give me 100 copies of your game. I'll make sure, you know, all my guys give it 4 or 5 star reviews, and people who may pay for that kind of stuff as well.
Yeah, based on, I mean, because I didn't use any of these, and these people never got keys for me, but based on the number of emails I've got, I would say there was definitely a problem there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't believe that, because these quite a large number of people were doing it. You know, someone must have been trying it, trying to use these Steam reviews. So I completely believe that there was a big, big problem there. And so, I mean, this seems to have fixed it. They fixed the problem. Was there a better way to do it? Maybe from my point of view, but I can't really blame Steam, because they have fixed a definite problem that existed.
Yeah, and it was kind of interesting, again, about, like, I've heard the same thing about how some developers get emails saying, you know, give me 100 keys, or, you know, I want to test your game out, can I have 55 keys, or something like that. And as someone who I would like to say I'm on the up and up with that, I've never asked for more than just, like, one key for someone's game. I just can't even fathom using, like, 20, 30 different keys. Now, again, for those of you listening, I'm not... Hey, I don't consider myself a professional streamer or stuff like that. I know streamers sometimes use giveaways. But I think for me, like in my emails, I think I mentioned this, I may have commented on that post. I, of course, include links to all my credentials. I even have that as like my new footer for the emails, or my signature, that it has, you know, name, YouTube page, Twitch, Twitter, the site, you name it. So I make sure that when I email someone, they have all my credentials down there in black and white.
Yeah, being able to prove who you are is a big thing. Generally, I mean, the developer's probably is not going to have a great deal of time to investigate that you are who you say you are. Mm-hmm. So you end up looking for red flags, like a Gmail address or a Yahoo address or whatever. That's a red flag. Or an email address that doesn't look quite right compared to the one that's on YouTube.
Yeah.
Or asking for multiple keys. Or an email that feels like a form letter, because you get a lot of those where people have obviously just cut and pasted in the name of your game. That kind of thing. So all those are red flags, and if you see 3 or 4 of those, I'm probably not going to go any further. Which means I probably have missed real people, because when things slow down. So when I did the update and did the Linux version, I got a lot less emails. I got about 16 or 17. So I had actually time to check through them. There's one person who sent me an email for a Linux website and basically pretty much triggered all of those red flags. But I think 3 out of 4 red flags. And normally that would be just, you know, next email. But instead, because I had the time, there weren't so many, I actually went through and checked and confirmed that there were a real person who really did control this website. Although it wasn't a very popular website, but I gave them the key anyway. But so just be careful that, you know, even if you're a real person, do you look like a real person is very important to someone who doesn't have a great deal of time.
Yeah, and that's one of the challenges I think, like, I've certainly had to prove that myself with emailing developers. I think it's definitely has gotten easier. I think for the most part, there's still times where I will email a developer and I will get nothing back from them, even if I email them 2 or 3 times. And I think that's when I think things get a little bit frustrating, because for you, Charles, with the emails that you've gotten from scams, like, is it always just like a fire and forget kind? Like, will they ever send a second or third follow up with you?
I don't think I've ever got a third follow up from someone I thought was a scammer. Mm-hmm. I've gotten a third follow-ups from marketing agencies and bundlers.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I have got two emails from scammers, normally months apart and normally exactly the same email again.
Okay. Yeah, but I usually, if I don't hear from someone, I will usually send a second email saying I just wanted to catch up or follow regarding my email. It will be an original email for that person. But, yeah, sometimes it can be tricky to separate, again, the signal from the noise when you're emailing people, and the other way around when developers are emailing YouTubers, journalists, etc.
Yeah, absolutely. I can only imagine what the Kotaku or the Rock Paper Shotgun contact email address looks like. It must be.
Yes, definitely.
It must be incredibly busy.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess following through up or continuing on with talking about keys, there's, of course, the challenge of reaching out to members of the press, like we already mentioned, for a press release standpoint. Now, with, like, YouTubers and stuff like that, that also offers its own unique challenges. There's been that debate about YouTubers asking for money or, I can't believe I forget the term off the top of my head, licensed content, is that what it is? When they have to let people know they're being paid or being asked to play a game specifically for money.
I did not have that with any of the YouTubers mm-hmm. I contacted. As I, of because I've got the statistics open here, 23% of the people,
mm-hmm.
23% of the people I sent a key to, YouTubers I sent a key to, mm-hmm. ended up making a video. And none of them asked for money at any point.
Mm-hmm.
The only one was one person asked for an extra key because they said they had three people on their podcast
mm-hmm.
and they needed an extra key for one of them, but not the third because he'd already bought the game. So okay. Sure, take it. In that case, what I did find actually though was a couple of the websites I sent keys to contacted me back very quickly asking for money.
Mm. The websites themselves, not YouTube.
The websites, yeah. I had no problem. No YouTuber asked me for money. I mean, I didn't, but two websites did. One for, and they both couched it in terms of, advertising and marketing. Mm. Like we will cover your game if you put on a full page ad. Mm. That was basically the quid pro quo.
Mm. Yeah, I know for a lot of people, it's definitely one of the more sketchier aspects of especially dealing with people in the industry when it comes to that kind of subject, especially for advertising. And there's still that, from what I've heard and what I've seen from like Facebook groups and stuff like that, there's still like a general stigma against indie game publishers. Like the companies I've heard of, I'm not going to name names, obviously, but I've heard from a lot of indie developers who say they don't like the idea of having to deal with a publisher or working with someone else while they're, to help make their game a success.
Working with a publisher.
Yeah,
I can't talk much about working with a publisher because I don't, mm-hmm. and I did it by myself.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I contacted a couple of publishers, perhaps a bit early in the process. Mm-hmm. They were very polite. Mm-hmm. I have to say every publisher I contacted got back to me, gave me a few short words of advice and said, a couple said no outright no, and one said come back to us later,
mm-hmm.
Which I didn't do, because by then I was already down the point of being on early access and ready mm-hmm. to go out.
Yeah, and. There's definitely, like, again, with, like, a lot of independent developers, that challenge of the best way to market yourself. And I'm sure we could easily have several podcasts dedicated to that very topic. As we mentioned earlier in the cast about, again, like, how to put your best foot forward. Because for a lot of game developers, many people don't have experience with the marketing and the PR side of things. And it seems these days that's becoming more and more of an important point in order to make your game a success.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a big part of my weakness when it comes to being an indie game developers, marketing wise, I really don't know what I'm doing. I just followed the, you know, just keep trying to do as much as you could, just sending out wherever you could. I guess the only difference, the only thing I could say is that I tried to keep statistics on how things went for future. So I know that, you know, the keys I sent to YouTubers resulted in, you know, more likely to result in some content, more likely to be, more likely to be, you know, at least mildly positive. Didn't result in anyone asking for money. And on, and at least one occasion, there was a notable difference to the number of sales as a result of the video. Whereas most of the websites I sent it to had, had no response. Nothing happened. They tended to be harsher. I don't really understand why about the game. And, the people who did cover it, they tended to be very small websites. I'm guessing only one or two people. And, you know, I don't think many people saw it. So from, certainly from my point of view, unless you get in front of some of the big websites, which are going to be very busy, as an indie developer, I think I'm far, far better off sending keys to YouTubers. Oh, and then the other thing I tried were things like, I tried a few giveaways, but I organized them myself rather than go through these groups. And, one of the best things I did was I did a Reddit, Ask Me Anything. But not on the main group, on the PC gaming group. And that, that worked really well. There was a lot of interest on that. And actually, I could measure, how many people came from that. And so I know that, several thousand people visited, the Steam page as a result of coming from that, that Ask Me Anything. And that's a significant number, during a sale period.
Yeah. And, I think I would agree with you about the, my weakness with marketing and social media as well. I mean, when we last spoke about 5-6 months ago, that was kind of like right at, I've only been like 2-3 months I've gone more into social media, more into marketing myself. And so far, this last half of the year has certainly been a huge uptake in terms of getting noticed by people. For instance, like we were talking about this earlier, my YouTube channel is, at this moment in time, is getting close to 1,000. I think when we last spoke 6 months ago, it was probably, I think, under 500 at that point. And
it was, yeah.
And as another point of reference, I've gone from having maybe 30 followers on Twitter to now having over 800 for this week. So it's definitely been a huge uptake. And I think, as you were saying earlier, Charles, that if you had to rebuild Conceal the Tent again, you would have, you would make it a lot better. And I think if I had a chance to, you know, go back and start from zero again with Game Wisdom, I think I would have done a whole lot more things different in that span than I did the first time around.
I know. I've been. I think I found you through when I was searching for YouTubers, and that was back when you were down in the I think the low 400s.
Because yeah,
I built up my list of people to send keys to a couple of months before I actually sent the keys. And I'm just I'm astounded by the growth. So you know, please, any pearls of wisdom you have on how to do that?
I think a lot of it has been reaching out for help and learning more about just like general YouTube audience. A friend and incidentally, my long-lost cousin that I found a few months ago gave me like a YouTuber's like playbook guide about things you can do to improve your channel, stuff like that. And I was already starting to do some of that. If you want, Charles, I can give you a link to that when we're done with the cast. And
that would be great.
It, just like with the YouTube thing, I think I was kind of like, I don't consider it to be like my main focus in the sense that I know, just like with Twitch, there are people on YouTube who that's literally all they do is just YouTube. And for me, I want to kind of be able to do multiple things. Like, it's not so much YouTube being my business, but Game Wisdom being like this brand that I want to grow. And I've been just trying to keep that quality going with everywhere I post and getting the word out there. I think it is definitely helping. It's still not at the point of being financially successful, but if again, like I always keep saying that, it feels like the irons are in the oven, and it's only going to take a little bit more for that spark to go off.
Yeah, I think, I've been working on the assumption that you just have to keep going, you just have to keep grinding away, and the more, basically, the more you do that, the more chances you have. Like, so you have a very small chance of things taking off. So you just got to keep doing it more and more, just as often and as repetitively as you can. Just keep doing it. Because, you know, if there's only like a 1 in 1,000 chance, then if you do it 500 times, then it's actually becomes a decent probability.
And
that's the assumption I'm working on.
So. Yeah, me too. I hope we're both proven right at some point here. I'm hoping that by the end of this year that we will hit 1,000 subscribers. Because I've heard and I've spoken to people that say that is a big deal. And there is a very good chance right now for that, those of you listening to this cast in the future, that we may have hit 1,000 by the time you're hearing this. So here's hoping that future Josh is a lot more excited right now.
I only wish you good luck.
Yeah, thank you. But getting back to like YouTube, and again, with that kind of challenge of growing things, it's definitely been, it has been hard, I think, especially for me. I honestly want to say it's been about a year and a half since I've really gotten busy with the YouTube channel. I was doing like light stuff with it before then, but I think it's been almost 2 years since I really decided to buckle down and make that a part of like the whole Game Wisdom brand. And I think with like with anything else, you have to do your research on it. And I think, as we said earlier, you have to make it as easy as possible for people to experience your content. Like, I'll give you an example of that. For the first half of a year, or maybe almost a year, I was putting out like 3 hours of content a day. Just, you know, streaming, putting it up. And I've learned from people and just from my own experience that there is such a thing as too much content. Who really is going to dedicate 3 hours to watch footage? So I've cut things down to now just the one big video a day and then the tiny critical thoughts. I think the critical thought, which I started, I want to say at this point 2-3 months ago, I think that's kind of been almost like the secret sauce that has been helping things out, because it is that kind of bite-sized content that I normally can't do with my videos. I mean, these podcasts are evident by the fact that I can talk for a very long time. And with the critical thoughts, it's giving me a chance to condense these topics into something that only takes 15, 20 minutes, maybe even less than that. And I think people are far more willing to watch something like that, even if it's just me sitting in front of a camera talking, compared to, you know, if I were to put up a 2-hour video of a video game.
Yes, and the other thing about those the shorter videos is you get to the point very quickly. So if this is from my point of view, if I sit down and watch it, I know very quickly what you're talking about and whether I feel it's relevant and interesting to me. And then there's the next 5 minutes with a deeper discussion, so I can very quickly go in and see what's happening. And that's also, I think, works really well. One of the things I found with like, Greenlight or Steam videos is you really want to get into the you really want to get into it very, very quickly.
Yes.
And I've seen a lot of videos where the first 10 seconds is just logos. This is our production company. I don't really care what your production company is. I don't know what your game is.
Yep. And I think, as you just said, getting to the point, not just with YouTube, but with like marketing your game is also very important. I've watched like random YouTubers who like have like 30, 40 minute like vlogs where it's like, oh, I went to the store today. I had to go do this and go that. I'm like, what is the point? Why are you telling me this stuff? And it's kind of weird like that with like the channel. It's almost become like a contradiction. On one hand, I have these longer videos than most YouTubers, and then on the flip side, I have these 10, 15 minute like bite-sized chunks a day as well.
Yeah, yeah. You should be able to get your point across quite quickly, and I think you do.
Yeah, and I think it has certainly helped. I think everything that I've been doing has been helping out. I was telling Charles about this before the cast, and I'm sure most of you have probably heard this by now, but if not, I've been putting together programs and presentations I'm going to try having at my local libraries and possibly expanding into doing like presentations at conferences in the future. So that's going to be like another area that I can say that I've grown from. I know that I wouldn't be thinking about this stuff like 6 years ago. I don't think I would be thinking about talking in front of a group of people about video games.
No. The same here. I'm not normally a very talkative person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me neither. And I have to say that after the fact that I've had days where I've talked for like 3 hours continuously. So people may be starting to call me on that one.
Yeah, as long as it's interesting.
Yeah. And going back to the idea of like the videos, the marketing videos for your games, that's another how many more of these topics we can easily break into. Like with Kickstarter, I've seen some videos that are just like a wacky sketch for 5 minutes before they actually talk about the game. Or it's just people saying how excited their game is and there's no footage of the game whatsoever. And there's one video that I keep going back to as like my favorite of the worst Kickstarter videos. It was, I'm not sure if you heard this one, Charles. It was for that, an RPG that, it had like the whole, it was a sketch of two women like arguing with each other about RPGs for 5 minutes. Like it made no sense whatsoever. I keep forgetting the name of the game, but I've pulled it up the YouTube video like several times in the past just to remind myself of what not to do.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of that one, but I can imagine it. Yeah,
if I can find it after.
Did they fund?
No, they stopped the Kickstarter. I think like 2 weeks in because it just wasn't making money. But yeah, it was like the worst video, and I should like have this bookmarked at this point. Oh my goodness, I'm trying to remember. Oh man, it's annoying me now. Now it's going to be in my head that I can't remember the name of this video, and now it's going to bother me until I look this up. But like as we're saying that you don't. While I'm going to quickly go through my history, but I'll see if I can multitask. You don't want to waste people's time when it comes to your content. Either get to the point or, you know, cut out what's not related to your video. And I think one thing that I've certainly learned is that it's better to have like 3 10-minute videos that are all on point versus 1 big video that's 30 minutes long that has like different topics in it.
Yeah, I think that sounds right to me. I think that could also almost be the theme of this discussion. Mm-hmm. Is that get to your point quickly, and because a lot of people don't have a huge amount of time or attention to give to you, so you need to get there quick.
Yeah, and then when you do want to do something big, then you have to make it interesting. Like, as you know, we do the live show once a week where it's usually a 40-minute to an hour-long discussion. Now, while that's great and all, that's not something we should realistically be doing each and every day because then it wears out its welcome. And again, you only have so many hours in a day to talk about or to watch and be able to consume content.
Yes, I guess based on what I just said a few seconds ago, I've actually just been thought of an immense number of exceptions to that rule. I mean, because when I say you need to get to your attention quickly, it's with, I think, with new people, with people who don't know you and want and don't already want what mm-hmm. the content you're providing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, the short ones are to you know, get to the point quickly to grab people in. This mm-hmm. is what I think, based on no evidence whatsoever. And then you can provide the longer ones. I mean, for instance, the whole concealed intent is not necessarily a short game.
Mm-hmm.
It takes you a bit of time. So the video sort of gets you in quickly in the hope that you'll be interested in the longer experience. And so I think that's sort of what you're saying here as well, is that, you know, the shorter ones give you a little taste and then you produce the longer ones mm-hmm. once a week for yeah. those people who you know are interested.
Mm-hmm.
Is that sort of what you were saying?
Yeah, like say the longer stuff for when for like something special, like a moment that something that you're not going to be repeating every day, day in and day out. Like, I also post these podcasts on YouTube, and again, it's the same thing. I don't post, you know, a podcast a day. That would be insane to ask someone to listen to, you know, an hour and a half to 2 hour discussion 5 days a week. So it's, again, once a week that goes up. And I think another part of that is getting into a routine of content. That's one of the things that's been like hammered into me, that once you figure out a cycle or figure out a baseline that works for you, and then keep to it. It's why for Game Wisdom, for instance, I try to do a post a day or an update a day. I mean, it's very easy. I could write, you know, 4 or 5 different posts a day, but I couldn't keep up at that pace. There's just no way. I would have probably killed my hands in the first year alone. So after I found that baseline, I just wanted to keep to it and focus on that. Because once people know what to expect, then they're more willing to, you know, come back a day. If it's, you know, one day I make 5 posts, next day I make 3 posts, then another day there's nothing, they're going to be like, it's going to be a lot harder for them to follow you.
Yeah. Yeah. And yes, it just keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, while we've been talking, I've been trying to find that video. It turns out I've been watching a lot more videos on YouTube than I thought I would. But I'm still going through it while we're saying this. And when it comes to, again, like putting yourself out there, I'm not sure if we personally talk about this, Charles, but I know on this cast, we've talked about the importance of good site design or having a place to show your game off. And that's another thing for developers listening to this cast that I cannot stress enough. Make sure your website is presentable. Not just your game, you know, the game site itself, but your company site. And this is another major deal. I talked with, I think, YouTuber Stefan of Complete Nonsense about this a few months ago, that your main site and your game site should be under the same basic web address for SEO purposes. And if I go to your website, just like what we talked about with the press copies of earlier in this cast, I shouldn't have to dig around to find out what your game is about. Or more importantly, this is one of my pet peeves too. Like, I shouldn't have to spend 10 minutes looking at your website to find a press email. There are some sites I've been on where it's a scavenger hunt to try and figure out how to send someone a damn email. And most people are not going to go that extra mile. And again, I think this could be the lesson for this cast, is you need to make your content and in many ways your game easy for people to get into.
Yeah, that's probably a better way of putting it than I put it. I might need to go back and take a look at my website now, actually. Yeah. I guess the only thing with that is, how do you find press kit?
I find, do you mean like the actual web? I know some developers have a quote-unquote press kit page on their site. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I think that's very useful. Even if it is, like, you don't really need a lot for it, but the more that's there, the better. Because usually, that's the second thing that I will look for on a site. I will, you know, scan for an email if there is nothing. Then I will look for a press kit. And also, very important, if you're going to have a press kit, make sure to include a link there for or something about getting a press copy for your game. Because I've seen some developers use it like, oh man, I hate when I forget the name of it, but one of the press sites I'm signed up for, who I get usually, I think, weekly updates, like they have like a simple way to put your link in and to request a press key. So if you don't want to do that task yourself, then set up something for people to send press key requests. Again, the easier it is for them to get in touch with you or get access to your game, the better.
I'm going to have to go and take a look at that right now.
We're going to have to pause the cast for a minute.
I just checked. I do have my email address on the contact page, but I do not have contact here for press copies.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's why it's probably too late now. It's too late now for Concealed Intent. I'll know for next time.
Mm-hmm. And again, I think that's another lesson that I've learned. I know we have certainly spoken about this before, is that in many cases, the things that you don't know will come back to bite you in this industry.
Yes, most definitely. I think that indie games, or certainly from my point of view, when you get in, you think, oh, right, I know how to write code, or I know how to do art, and so I can make simple games.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot to the business side of it. And if you just want to write your games and put them up for free,
mm-hmm.
that's fine. But if you want to actually make a business of it, it is quite a serious thing. It's a competitive landscape,
yeah.
Business area, and you have to be prepared to put in the effort.
Mm-hmm. And that's one thing I think for enthusiasts or students who are interested in getting in the industry that they need to hear more of. I've said this multiple times in the cast that the game industry is a fun business, but at the end of the day, it's still a business. You have to do this kind of plan. You have to look ahead. And as you said, Charles, there's a difference between being a hobbyist in this industry and someone who is making a living off of this industry. And there is a lot more work that goes into the latter than there is in the former.
Yes, most definitely. It is possible, when you say it's a business, it is possible to be in this industry not as a business.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that actually then later turns on into a business. I mean, the first mm-hmm. people who come to mind there are the Dwarf Fortress people. I mean, they just started writing it, and then later on, after it was already a successful game, then they put the business around it. Well, not mm-hmm. really business, just donations, isn't it? Enough to keep going. But if you do want to make a living from it, and you have to take it as a proper business and do the business stuff,
mm-hmm.
and that involves some work. And there's a video up, I think, on the GDC channel recently mm-hmm. by Grey Alien Games. I think it was 10 years in indie games without a hit, mm-hmm. and it's quite an interesting video about how this solo developer has managed to sustain himself and his family as a business, making indie games without ever having a very successful game. I don't know if you've ever heard of Grey Alien Games. I haven't.
No, before I started. I haven't.
I think the only game of theirs which I'd even heard of was Regency Solitaire.
Oh, I think I've heard of that one.
Yeah, but yeah, I've never played it. I've only heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was in a Humble Bundle recently, and that's how I heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the guy behind that has existed for 7 years, and he just went through what it takes. Mm-hmm. And basically, it sounds like quite a bit of work, and more than just writing the games. It was a lot of, clearly he'd done a lot of analysis from the very beginning, a lot of recording of information and sales, and then a lot of analysis about what works and what doesn't work, and just mm-hmm. just kept going, kept sort of reassessing how he thought things should continue on, so that he could continue being an indie developer. It is actually a pretty good life being an indie developer if you can sustain it.
Yeah, and that's actually a very interesting thing about being an indie developer without having a breakout hit. And that's another thing that's very, I think that's one of those weird things from consumer side of things from the developer side. A lot of people think that the indie market is about those breakout hits, your Undertales, your Stardew Valleys, Gone Home, Dear Esther, the like. But for the vast majority of indie developers, it's simply about making a game that comes out that you've earned at least enough money to keep going on. Like, there are, for every major hit, there's probably a few dozen games that have been released that have kind of came and then went before anything else happened.
Yeah, I think if you go through Steam, because Steam being mm-hmm. by far the largest market for these indie PC games, and you look at the publishers of small games, if they're self-published, there's normally only one there.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe there's two. Very few people... unless they go to a big publisher, or you look at, say, better to look at the developers. Like, if you look at the small indie developers, they've only really got one or two, and then you're done. And the people who seem to survive longer are the people who have those big hits, and then they live off the money from that first big hit. The people I think of immediately there would be people, like the AI War people.
Yeah.
Arsene.
Mm-hmm.
That, that AI War was a huge hit. It's quite dated now. But it was a huge hit, made a lot of money, and then most of the other games haven't been anywhere near as successful, but mm-hmm. they can still survive off that big hit.
Yeah, and I've actually spoken with Chris Park from Arkane a few times about that very topic. AI Wars, he said, literally has been keeping his company going for the last few years. Like, the success of that one game has been enough to sustain them, but it has been just very difficult, again, to keep yourself going as an indie developer. And that's another thing that I think more people need to understand, is that just because you make one amazing game, that doesn't necessarily mean that you are now set for life. And I think, as we said earlier, with the idea of refinement and iterating on your design, the real test or the real metal of a game developer is what they do with their second or third game, because that's when we see if that developer really, you know, has the talent to be able to sustain themselves in this industry. And I know we've sort of talked about this topic in the past, but I don't think we've really dedicated like a full cast to it. But there is the fact that there's very few quote-unquote old timers in the game industry, you know, the people who have been doing this successfully for 20, 30 years.
Certainly not among the indie crowd, but then yeah. The indie games have only really existed for about 10 years.
Yeah.
As I've been aware of.
Yeah, there have been, like, I know Introversion has been around since, I want to say, the mid-90s, so has Crow Team. But in terms of what we quote-unquote consider an indie developer, the indie market, it's really only been, I want to say, about 7 or 8 years, maybe a little less than that, that the indie market as we know it has been in existence.
That sounds about right to me. Yeah.
And while we've been talking, I've been scrolling down my YouTube wheel or my YouTube history, and I found the game, Mooncrest. That was the Kickstarter of one of the most cringeworthy things I've seen for a Kickstarter pitch.
I have written down that name.
Yeah, be sure to watch that when we're done here. And just, like, take notes on what not to do with that one. And for those of you watching or listening to this as well, do the same.
Put it in the show notes.
Yeah, there we go. That is a good idea. Maybe if I can, I'll see if I can find the version of that video. But, yeah. And I think we will probably, let me check our time here. We are just about over an hour and 15 in. I'm trying to think if there's any other, we've certainly rambled on enough about the importance of getting to your point. I think we're getting close to not practicing what we preach there.
Yes, maybe.
I'm trying to think if there's any other, while I'm trying to think of this on my end, for you, Charles, are there any other aspects or post-mortem topics that we haven't brought up yet that you would like to touch on?
A couple of things spring to mind. What I found, let me just bring up my spreadsheet here.
Mm-hmm.
I also put some stats on the possibility of advertising. I never did any advertising, but how much I'd be willing to pay with advertising. Just gets an interesting look at how many people buy games based on looking at your website and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I pretty much found that during release, and maybe it would be worthwhile. In that, I earned on the order of about $1 for every 1,000 impressions.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that makes it reasonable. But the vast majority of your time, the value of someone looking at your website is much, much lower.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I thought this was interesting is actually not because of those numbers, but about what it says about how much you sell during sales. And I've noticed this just recently with the current sale and with the – because we're recording this during the autumn Steam sale
mm-hmm.
and during the 1.1 sale, is that – even now, just a couple of months after my game has come out, so what, 4 months after mm-hmm. the game has come out, sales outside, the number of people purchasing the game outside of sales has already dropped to an incredibly low level, about the same as I was selling during early access, which is not many.
Mm-hmm.
But during a sale, it really does, there's a huge and noticeable spike every time. It's definitely something that's caught my eye. And the other thing that's interesting with these is that every time there's a spike in sales, my refund rate drops.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that very interesting because it seems to me that there's two possibilities. Because my game is a bit of a niche game.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm expecting people to buy it by accident or not enjoy it and want to refund it. So there are two possibilities I see it. Firstly, either people who buy during sales don't play the game compared to people who buy outside of sales, or that people are waiting for the sales, which I think is also quite likely. Or there was a third possibility, which I've now immediately forgotten. Or people, if the less you pay for a game, the less likely you are to refund it. I'm not sure how to tell the difference between those.
Yeah, that's what I was just about to say there, Charles, that I think it goes with the fact that, as you just said, the lower the price barrier is, I think the more willing people are going to be to keep that game. Like, if you buy a game for $30 and, you know, 20 minutes in, it sucks and you hate it, it's like, why do I want to keep playing this? It's $30 of my money. I'm going to refund it. But if, let's say, you buy a game and it's $1 and, you know, it's all right, but it's not, like, wowing you, it's not that big of a deal to your wallet compared to, again, like a $30 or $40 expense.
Yes. That seems to be a very likely possibility.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd love to be able to split it out and just tell how much it is related to those three things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's very tricky about, again, like with the use of sales. Because, I mean, right now as we're recording this cast, the Steam, I guess this is considered the autumn sale or the Thanksgiving sale, one of those two, is going on right now. So this is, again, one of the big times, of course, Black Friday, Cyber Monday. And there's always that challenge of how much do you want to put your game on sale for? Because, again, if you put your game down to like $2 or $1, yes, people are going to buy that. But in all honesty, you're not really going to be making much money at $1 or $2 a copy.
Yeah, and I have to say, I actually agonized for a day over what the discount I should put on Concealed Intent.
Mm-hmm.
Because they call it in the back end the autumn sale and the winter sale, and they come up at the same time. So you put in the amount that they're going to be for both sales at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And they suggest that you put it as both the same. Oh, I probably shouldn't have said that. they suggest that you put it both the same.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's a big thing. I mean, if you look, you can set it to anything you want, but they suggest it's the same. So I thought I'd do that. I set it the same. So I was like, how much should it be? It's been out for 4 months. It's previously been on, I think, 40% sale. So should I put it to 50 or should I put it to 40? Because it was only at 40% a month ago. It's a really hard decision to make. And then obviously you also have to take into account that you're going to get a boost in sales, and the boost will be bigger the discount.
Mm-hmm.
But, how much does it, do you really make? Because, I mean, is it linear? The bigger the discount, is the sales going to be just linear, so you actually end up with the same amount of money, or is it going to be more than linear, so you end up with like more money than you would have done?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of things to consider there, and looking at many indie games, I think they just go 90%, 75%. Just make the sales.
Yeah. And as you were just saying, it is a very big deal about how much you put your game on sale for, because it's kind of like a catch-22. You put too high of a sale, then you anger your fans who spend full price or 80% of the full price on the game. You don't put it on sale high enough, then you have people saying, you know, why are you being such a cheapskate? You know, what's going on, kind of thing.
Yeah, and you will get emails from people telling you both things.
Yeah, exactly. And on the Steam forums as well.
Yeah, I've got emails from people telling me that I'm not discounting fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got other people saying, you know, I made a pledge on the Steam forums and on my on the website and whatever that I wouldn't bundle the game for a year. And quite a few people have sent me emails saying, "Oh, that's great! Thank you very much for that."
Mm-hmm.
You know, we wish more. We wish more people would do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then on the converse, I've got other people sending me emails going, discount faster.
Yeah. And it's one of those just lose-lose options there for developers, because you never know. Again, it's impossible to know, you know, the sweet spot for your game. And even with your initial pricing, that's, I mean, easily, we start talking about game prices, we'll be here for another 2 hours, I think.
Yes. Well, I think that might be you more talking than me, because I just sort of tossed a number out of the air, really.
Yeah,
I had no special knowledge. It's just what seemed right.
Mm-hmm. And as we said earlier, like, the quote unquote race to the bottom is certainly a real issue for a lot of indie developers. And again, it's one thing that it's not going to be solved overnight. I think it is. I don't want to say it's improving, but it's kind of really hard to tell. Like, I'm kind of out of the mainstream market at this point with all the press copies and just focusing on sales, so I can't really give any solid advice on what I'm buying with my money, kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's still a lot of bundles around. I think that's, when you talk about race to the bottom really is these bundles. And there's still a lot of them around. But I look at a lot of them now, and I don't recognize the names anymore. I mean, it used to be that I looked at these websites, oh, wow, I really wanted that game. No, it's on my wish list. But now, that's very rarely the case. And in fact, even with Humble Bundle, which is, you know, maybe once a month or once every 2 months, I'll go, oh, that's such a great bundle. So the general, it seems to me, falling out of the mainstream as well. I don't get free games. But either I'm falling out of the mainstream, or the quality of games in the bundles, I shouldn't say quality, the marketing clout of the games in the bundles has greatly dropped. And so they're not as compelling as they used to be. And maybe that's the case that there's just more games around, so your attention is split into smaller and smaller chunks for each game. Or maybe it's something else. Or maybe the more bigger games, they don't bundle themselves anymore. So it is perhaps getting better, as you say. I don't know the answer. I think it's one of those things that we may find out in a year or two's time.
Yeah.
Looking back, rather than right now, where we're in the middle of it.
Yep. And the same can be said about what's going on with the mobile market and what's been happening there with trying to get more established away from just the major names of Rovio, King, and Zynga.
Yeah, I don't have any particular insight there. What I've heard is that it's actually getting worse there, and that the big names are taking more and more of the screen space and the attention of possible purchasers. Whereas the impression I get in Steam, at least, is that that's not the case, because they keep trying, very much to their credit. Steam keeps trying to put up the not so big games in people's faces. I think I can only, because they keep changing their recommendation system and things like that, and they keep saying, at least, that they're trying to help people find the smaller games that they may like, or the less popular games, because everyone knows about Call of Duty or Dota, all those things.
Yeah.
But that's the smaller ones, they just sort of disappear.
And I was saying this like in a post, I think, last week, but even as someone who's trying to keep track of things, I even post on Twitter, you know, let me know there's any games coming out worth checking out. I know I keep missing games, and it's becoming harder and harder to find them. I mean, I can't even imagine what it must be like trying to search through like the mobile development, like mobile stores or iOS, and trying to find someone's game on there.
Yes. And when I released, I mean, I moved a week to avoid No Man's Sky. But the day I released, I think there were something like five or six other games coming out, and there was five or six games the day before and five or six games the day after. And I released the same day as This Is the Police. I can't remember. That was the big game that came out that day. And I hadn't heard of it until I saw it. in the list of top sellers the day I release. Oh, this is the police. I think it's called This Is the Police. I can't remember the name. And then I went and looked up reviews of it. It looks like a good game. It's in my wish list now. Mm-hmm. It's there's just a huge amount out there.
Definitely. All right, we are now at an hour and a half in. I think it is probably time to wrap it up. So I'm trying to, my mind is starting to blank of any more topics. So once again, I'll turn to you, Charles. Do you have anything else you want to talk about before we say goodnight?
No, I think I'm largely done. My game is Concealed Intent. Take a look at it. There will be another update, 1.2. Mm-hmm. And I'm working on another game, but I'm not talking about it yet.
Okay. All right. I guess with those final words, we'll start to wrap it up. Again, Charles, thank you so much for coming on. And I do, at least, I know it's been a few months of the game's come out, but once again, I do want to say congratulations on getting the game out. I've spoken to developers in the past who've even struggled with just getting their first game out. And I know it can be a monumental task for that first game for a lot of people.
Yes, there's, no matter what the sales are, no matter how many people play it, and I know that a few people have contacted me to say that they incredibly enjoy it, but no matter what, it's out, I've done it, and it's hard to describe how proud I am that I managed to do this at least once.
Yep. All right. And again, definitely looking forward to your next project, whatever it may be at this moment. And hopefully when the time comes, we can certainly talk about that here on the cast.
I'll be sending you a key and I'll make sure I put a screenshot in.
Awesome. All right. So with that said, we're going to end things here for tonight. As always, thank you so much for tuning in, and if you would like to support Game Wisdom, we have several options available. If you'd like to be a guest or write a guest piece for the site, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. We are always looking for new guests to come on to talk with us. Or, I've been also, as I just said, if you're working on a game that you would like me to take a look at, whether it's on Game Wisdom or on the YouTube channel, be sure to get in touch with me. My email again is josh@game-wisdom.com. If you would like to follow me, you can follow me on Twitch and Twitter under GW Bicer for the latest updates and when I do my streams. And of course, check out the Game Wisdom YouTube channel, which is certainly getting up there. And hopefully by the time you hear this, we'll be at 1,000 subscribers. You can find me on YouTube under Game Wisdom, and there are, of course, plenty of links to that on the front page. And last but not least, you can find me on Patreon under Game Wisdom. Donations will be greatly appreciated and will allow me to support myself and my family. And if we can hit some goals, it will mean expanding more content for everyone to enjoy. So, once again, Charles, thank you so much for coming on tonight. I wish you the best of luck with your game, and hopefully we'll talk again in, 2 or 3 months or 3 to 4 years in terms of our time span here.
Yes. Thank you very much for having me on.
Awesome. All right. So, for those of you listening, once again, thanks for tuning in. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care.